Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sun Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. Some show notes real quick before we jump into things with our guest today. If you are looking for some wrestling today, tonight, in our the neck of the woods, you have Defy Wrestling here in Seattle. You have also in Indianapolis, Indiana, like usual, at the Outlaw Arena, WCWO. We have PWA in Campbell River, B.C., EWF in Covina, California, FIP in Tampa, Florida, SXPW in Port Richey, Florida, NSCW in Franklin, Kentucky tonight. Tomorrow night, HPW back at it in Columbus, Indiana, Emerge also in Columbus, Indiana, RCW in Hazel Green, Alabama, CSW in Colorado Springs, Colorado, BBW in Sacramento, California, WXW in Mineola, Florida, PWA in Springfield, Illinois, ICW in Marion, Indiana, NWP in Terre Haute, Indiana, TNW in Hartford, Kentucky, NWL in Joplin, Missouri, All-Star Wrestling in Julian, West Virginia, and WVCW in Bluefield, West Virginia, featuring Casey Carlisle tomorrow night. Without further ado, I would like to welcome our guest onto the show today. He is noted wrestling historian and author, Scott Teal. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Thank you for joining us here today. And since it's your first time with us, I will give you the first-timer's question to start things. What led to you getting into the business of professional wrestling?
Just to boil down to one few words, is just my love for it. Yeah, I discovered it in 1968 and watched every single program that came on. Every time the newspaper came out, I'd look in the newspaper for ads and find out what was playing, who was playing, wrestling where. And just fell in love with it. Started taking pictures in Florida and eventually moved to Nashville, Tennessee, where the promoter asked me to come work for him.
At that point in time in Nashville, are we talking about Nick Gulas as the promoter?
Yes, that was 1974. I moved up here and I didn't go to the match as much. I came up here to go to college, and I went to the matches a few times and knew some of the wrestlers from Florida, and when they'd see me, I'd take pictures and do some of their publicity shots. And I guess word got around, because I really don't know how Nick found out about me, but I went to Huntsville, Alabama to a big show they had there. One night I rode down with Don Green, one of the wrestlers, and while I was there, I was taking pictures at ringside, and somebody came up and said, Nick wants to see you in the back. And I said, okay. And I hadn't had anything to do with Nick or anybody else, really. I kept to myself, really. I was real respectful of the guys. I didn't go up to them all the time asking for autographs or any of that. I just took pictures and sent them into the magazines. And so anyway, I went to the back and sort of scared. I was like, oh no, what did I do wrong? Or I was afraid they're going to tell me, they didn't want me around there, quit hanging around the ring, hanging on the ring apron, taking pictures. And I thought, well, they're just going to tell me to get out of here. But I got back there, and I believe George Gulas was there with his dad. But they asked me to come if I'd like to come work for him, doing photography and helping him with publicity and things. And that's what I did, and it was the best decision I ever made, because for the next 5 years, I was actually living a dream come true, traveling with the guys. I had complete dressing room privileges. I could go in and out just like one of the boys. And it was just, I had a ball. I mean, the next 6 years, it was just great.
Now, in the early 90s or so, at some point you got involved with Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and you were kind of helping them track down wrestlers that we have not seen or heard from in some time and giving a little bit of an update about what it was they were doing. How did you get involved into that aspect of the business?
Well, 1996, I believe it was 90. Yeah, I believe it was 96. There was a guy here in Nashville who put on a, he called it like a flea market, old time legends thing. And he was bringing in 10, 12, 15 old time wrestlers. Now I was out of the business. I got out of the wrestling business in 1980 and, because Nick sold his business to Buddy Fuller, and Buddy Fuller somehow was the middleman between Nick and Jerry Jarrett. So I got out of the business, and when this guy put on this legend show, he asked me if I could help him create some flyers, because at the time I was one of the very few people that had a computer. I mean, they just, you know, they weren't, most people didn't have one. And I had a printer, and I had learned how to make flyers and things like that. And I don't even know where the guy got my name. His name was Don Rowlett. I don't know how he got my name, but he asked me to help with flyers. I said, well, sure, I'd be glad to. And at that point, I really hadn't had any contact with anybody other than just a couple guys that I'd stayed in touch with for 16 years. And in the course of the putting in the flyers and everything, the program and everything together for that event, the guy called me one day, the promoter, and he says, I talked to Dick Steinborn yesterday, and he asked me, whatever happened to Scott Teal? Well, strangely enough, that struck a chord in me, and I started doing a newsletter called Whatever Happened To. And I just still had my old address book and phone book, and I started calling a lot of the old-time wrestlers and doing just real short interviews with them to find out where they were doing. Because for most of the wrestlers, especially back in the 80s and 90s, when they got out of the wrestling business, they disappeared. You know, people didn't hear about them. The Wrestling Observer wasn't real widely read at the time, so most fans were in the dark about who was where. And so I started publishing this little newsletter, and it turned out to be a 50-page magazine that I put out, supposed to be every month, but, it'd be a little bit longer than that. And inside that magazine, I'd have their name, their address, their phone number, plus this short little interview I did. And as time went on, it grew, and the interviews got longer and longer. And somewhere along the line, I can't remember the name of the magazine, but whatever it was with, I guess it was the Pro Wrestling Illustrated people. They got in touch with me and asked me if I'd like to do a regular feature for their newsstand magazine. And that's how that came about. That actually came about through my Whatever Happened To Wrestling magazine. And it was Inside Wrestling is what that feature was in. And it was I actually called the article Whatever Happened To, just like my wrestling article. Or wrestling magazine.
Now, having been in the business for a while and then coming up with this newsletter, did you find it was easier to track down guys at this point in time, or was it still kind of a chore to track down a lot of the guys that you wanted to find out about?
It wasn't tough. I had a good core of guys that I had known and traveled with back in the 70s. And so, I started with them shortly after. It was a real short time after I started doing the newsletter. Someone called and told me about the Gulf Coast Wrestlers Reunion in Mobile, Alabama. They had been doing it about 2, maybe 3 years by the time I found out about it. And I got an invitation anyway to that reunion, and it was a closed reunion. It was just open to the boys. You had to have been in the wrestling business at some point or another, and got invited to that reunion. And at that reunion, I mean, the first time I went, I guess there must have been, I'd say, 90 to 100 wrestlers there, old-time wrestlers. So I was able at that reunion to, you know, I handed out flyers that explained, you know, the whatever happened to. I talked to a lot of the guys. And a lot of the guys I knew, you know, from years before. And as I talked to the guys and interviewed guys for my magazine, they would give me names of other guys that, you know, I was wondering, didn't know where they were. And over the course of time, you know, I just developed a huge, massive list of wrestlers and addresses and phone numbers. And one of the cool things about my old newsletter magazine, the Whatever Happened To, as I said, I put the in the newsletter itself, I'd put the guys' phone numbers and addresses. They always, you know, always ask for permission. But all the guys, almost all the guys, loved what came about of those interviews, because when I'd interview them and publish it after it came out, because I'd get orders from all over the country, and after it came out, these guys would call and they'd say the newsletter they absolutely loved. They loved the idea of it, and they were so excited because fans were calling them or fans were writing them asking them for. You know, if they could have things signed, a picture signed. And of course, this is the time before eBay. People weren't getting things signed just to sell. You know, people were doing it because they just absolutely loved pro wrestling, and they loved getting the autographs of these guys who never before had opened up to people. You know, they never talked freely about the wrestling business before this. You know, they were always tight-lipped and. You know, they towed the party line. You know, wrestling was all real. You know, they wouldn't tell anybody anything. But in my magazine, they opened up because they knew me and they realized things were changing and the wrestling business was becoming exposed to the general public. But the wrestlers absolutely loved the attention they were getting from the fans because for years they had been super mega stars to the people in all these, you know, cities and states all around the country. And then when they got out of the wrestling business, they were just old Joe Schmuck. You know, they're really just an average, ordinary, everyday guy. And they didn't get that attention they used to get. So when they started getting letters from fans telling them how much they enjoyed listening, you know, watching them when they were a kid, watching them wrestle, it really made them feel good, and it sort of put a little, I don't know how to describe it, little something extra in their life, you know, made them feel like they were somebody again.
Now, at some point in time, you ventured from writing the newsletter and contributing to Pro Wrestling Illustrated to actually publishing autobiographies along with some of the legendary wrestlers. You've done several books with a pretty good variety of wrestlers. What led you to getting into the book publishing world?
Well, I had always dreamed of going into a bookstore and having a book published that was there on the bookshelves in the bookstores. And I just never actually did it. And we were in Mobile, back to Mobile again, one year. It used to be such a wonderful reunion because we used to stay at the Red Roof Inn there in Mobile. And there, you could walk down the breezeway, one room after another. And in every room, there was 8, 9, 10, 15 wrestlers all crowded in, sitting on the floor, sitting on the bed, sitting on the counter, telling stories. It was so much fun. And one year, I was in a room, and Ole Anderson and I had gone in there. We'd been out to dinner, and so we went in there, and we're sitting in there listening, telling stories, and laughing. And when we left, Ole walked across the parking lot. He says, "I'll see you in the morning." I said, "Okay." He got halfway across the parking lot to his car, and he says, "You know, we ought to write a book." And I said, "Boy, that sounds great. Let's do it." And we went on and finished the reunion that weekend. Well, I didn't think anything else about it. I mean, I thought about it, but I sort of thought maybe he was just, you know, just threw that off, really didn't mean it. And about 8 months later, he called me and he says, "Scott," he says, "when are we going to get started on that book?" I said, "Well, anytime you're ready." I mean, at that point, it just hit me like a bolt of lightning. You know, he's ready. He really wants to do this. So Ole and I, that must have been, let's see, the book came out in November 2003, so I say that must have been either the beginning of 2003, probably the end of 2002. And we talked on the phone. I recorded, I asked him a million questions, and We recorded everything every night for an hour or two, and before I knew it, we had like 80 hours worth of interview on tape. So then began the process of transcribing the tape, editing it all down, calling it Ole for other questions I had, checking on things, you know, doing the research, be sure things that were said were correct. And before I knew it, we had a book. And that was the very first book. It was called Inside Out with Ole Anderson. And we sold the book at Fan Fest in Charlotte. And I had never seen anything like it. They had a line for our table, for our book, a line that from the time they opened Thursday morning until Sunday afternoon when that Fan Fest finished, there was somebody in that line all the time waiting to buy a book. We sold almost every book we had. It was unbelievable. I never seen anything like it. Probably, and I'm sure I never will again. But it was the first book, actually, that was out about pro wrestling where, you know, a real key figure from the old days really opened up. Mick Foley had just written his book, I believe, but he wasn't an old timer. You know, he was more of a current day type wrestler. So, you know, people really latched onto it. And that weekend while we were there selling the book, Ivan Koloff came to the table and wanted to know if I'd help him write a book. J.J. Dillon came and asked me if I'd help him write a book. And it just snowballed from there. And to this, as of my last book, I've published 33 books. And right now I have anywhere 8 to 10 actually in the works in some form or fashion.
Now, obviously, with all of these books, I'm sure, considering the wrestlers involved, there's been a few things that have been a little bit shocking to have learned about some of these guys. What would you say has been the most shocking thing that you've learned in the course of writing these books?
I mean, there's a lot of things that shock me. I mean, usually it's about the way they live. The wrestling with business was pretty wild back in the day. The things they did. I mean, it's just like all sports figures. It's the same, you know, with the girls and the drinking and the partying and all that. We didn't have a problem with drugs back then, you know. So most of the guys I talked to, it isn't a problem about, you know, it wasn't a situation with drugs. But I guess the most shocking thing, it would probably be that these guys, who when I was young and first watching wrestling, even up until I started writing, until I started doing my magazine anyway, I thought these guys were superstars in the eyes of the public. I mean, everybody in town knew who they were. They could walk down the street, everybody knew them. It isn't like today, you know, there's a number of people who know about wrestling, but if you ask everyday Joe on the street, he wouldn't know who any of those people are that wrestle. Well, back then they were stars, and I always figured, you know, these guys are superstars. They're probably millionaires making all this money. And when they retired, they're all retired, you know, financially set. I guess what shocked me most of all is so many of them weren't making very, very good money. I never realized that I realized it to an extent because I was in the business, but I never realized it was bad as it was until, you know, I started doing the magazine and I'm learning that these guys, a lot of them are dead broke. They're working regular jobs and scraping by, which is a shame, you know, especially when you look at these guys and you see what superstars they were back in the day. You know, you'd think they were all, you know, making all this money, but that just wasn't the case. So that's probably the thing that surprised me the most about pro wrestling. And I probably learned that more after I got into the business in 1975, you know, but it became even more apparent once I started doing my books.
Obviously, today's wrestling fans are much different than the fan base that was around for the bulk of the wrestlers that you've helped write for book-wise. Do you ever get angry fans commenting on things, wishing that things weren't as open as they are now? Do you have the people that still want to see the wrestlers as they saw them when they were superstars?
No, not in the fans' respect. I don't think I've ever, you know, heard a fan say they don't you know, they wish things were like they were, and people weren't allowed to know what's going on behind the scenes, and people were kept in the dark about, you know, the true workings of pro wrestling, how, you know, who decided who wins and loses, you know, and how all that works. I've never had a fan say that. In fact, I'd say 100% of the people who are fans and were fans, they want to know more, you know, because they have appreciation for it. You know, it isn't because they want to find out the secrets and, you know, hurt the business. It's, but they just love the business so much. And now that they went every week to the wrestling in whatever city they live. Now they're finding out how all this actually worked, what went on behind the scenes. And it's fascinating to them. You know, to find all these things out. Whereas before they thought, you know, they were told everything was a shoot. In other words, everything was real. You know, everything that happened was right down the line. There was no faking or any of that. So, no, the fans now, on the other respect, I never had any problem getting a guy to open up to me because I had been in the business and I had traveled down the road and they all knew me and they all trusted me. I have had guys that would say, well, I'm willing to talk to an extent about the pro wrestling business, but I'm not going to expose it completely. I don't want to come right out and say the matches were pre-arranged and so-and-so told us, you know, how we do things. But there's very few guys that really even said that. Most of them were so just willing to talk because they knew the bloom was off the rose. You know, things were opened up. Vince McMahon even went, you know, before the Pennsylvania Sports Athletic Commission and told the world that pro wrestling was entertainment. That's exactly what it was. It wasn't an athletic competition. There's a lot of athleticism in it. I mean, a bunch even today, but it's not actual competition as far as, you know, in the ring. So, but yeah, there has been just a handful of wrestlers that I never had been able to crack, you know, to get to actually open up. I'd say almost 100% of them would open up to me, but there was a handful that would say, I'll tell you whatever you want to know, but I don't want it in print because I don't want to come out and expose the business and tell people that what we were doing wasn't all real. But even that today, there's not a wrestler I can think of that wouldn't be willing to actually go on, you know, on record and talk about those things.
Now, obviously you've put out a lot of books with a lot of wrestlers, but you don't have the exclusive market on it. Do you ever read some of the other wrestling biographies and autobiographies out there to see what some of the other wrestlers have been doing as far as their books go?
I read almost all the books. I don't read a lot of the real new, like I don't want to mention any names. You know, the guys that have been wrestling, they maybe didn't get started in the wrestling business until 1995 or the year 2000. You know, I don't bother much with them. It just depends on who it is. But I do read them, read several of them, but there's really not a whole lot of difference. There's a difference in the way they view the wrestling business, because a lot of the guys that didn't come into the business till year 2000 or after, it was a totally different business. So things weren't the same. You know, I wouldn't ask them the same questions anyways, because they didn't have the kayfabe and the problems with the fans as much, you know, that we did back then. Back then, you know, riots were, you know, every week occurring. Well, not every week, but you know, they happened all the time in the arenas. You know, people would pull out knives and threaten or stab the wrestlers. There's been cases where somebody brought a gun to the matches and would shoot at the heels, the bad guys. Those things happen. But, yeah, I read most of the biographies, and I enjoy them. There's a lot of guys, several other people that are not published, but they have written great, great books on pro wrestling. Greg Oliver and Steve Johnson, they have a series, four different books on pro wrestlers. One's on the Canadians, one's on tag teams, the other's on the heels, and they've got another one in the works coming out soon. There's other authors who have done great, wonderful books on strictly pro wrestling history, not necessarily biographies. those like Mark Hewitt, he's written a lot of books on the old time, what they call catch wrestling. You know, it was the real shoot wrestling when the guys were really, really in the ring, you know, trying to be actual competition. Tim Hornbaker, he's written books on the NWA and the formation of Capital Sports, Vince McMahon, you know, which led into Vince McMahon's WWE today. That's where all that got started. So yeah, there's a lot of books on there that I've enjoyed and that I read.
And do you have a particular favorite author of wrestling that you enjoy?
I couldn't really even answer that one because I really don't think I have a favorite. All the books I've read, like the authors I've just mentioned, you know. I've enjoyed, there's something about them all that I enjoy. You know, if I learn something from it, and a lot of times I'll read a book and there'll be things in there that brings questions in my mind. I think, well, what about this? And that leads me to maybe going to talk to, you know, to some other wrestler or somebody else, maybe another wrestling historian, to find out more about that and maybe to even to clear up some things, some questions that a book might lead to, you know. So I learned something from all of them. Mark James, I love his books. I don't know if you're familiar. He's got a lot of books he's written on Memphis, Tennessee. All the old cards that they used to, you know, all the old results. He's written books with a lot of the wrestlers from Memphis, and I've learned a lot from his books as well.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, so I want to pass things over to him for a bit.
Okay. I didn't know anybody else was here. Hi. Is it QT?
QT, yes. That stands for quite terrific.
I thought it just meant you were cute or something. Cutie.
Oh, well, there is that element, too, yes.
You'd make a good heel, I can tell right now.
Oh, no. A tweener. I'm a baby face or heel. I'm like a layer of lukewarm water.
Yes. There you go. Well, that way you can go with whatever it calls, it calls for.
Yes. I have an instinct of whether to turn heel or baby face or remain a tweener. It depends on the venue, Matt.
There you go. That's right. That's right. Good to talk to you.
Well, Scott, Sign Guy, you told Sign Guy earlier that you had lived in Florida before you moved to Nashville. What part of Florida did you live in?
I lived in Bradenton. It's about 30 miles below Tampa. And that's actually, like I said, where I cut my teeth in pro wrestling. The first pro wrestling card, I was going to say was right there in Bradenton at the old National Guard Army. It's just a tiny little building. I don't think the building held more than, I'd say, maybe 150 people. The chairs and the bleachers were set up around the ring, but it was really tight. But it was a cool atmosphere. But I believe the first match, if I remember right, was in Tallahassee, Florida. I was up there one summer for a music camp. They had a music camp at Florida State University. And when I was a sophomore in high school, I went up there for that and saw all these posters in the windows and just went down to I'm wanting to say it was the Armory in Tallahassee, but I think it was called the Semco Building or something like that. And so that would have been the first card. But that's where I grew up, was Bradenton. And the matches that I saw actually on TV actually came out of Tampa.
Okay. Now, is Tampa on the west coast of Florida or the east?
It's on the west coast. It's about halfway down the state in what they call Central Florida.
Oh, okay. So you were right next to the Gulf of Mexico, the eastern
Absolutely.
Gulf of Mexico.
Yes, we spent a lot of our weekends right there on the beach on the west coast in the Gulf.
Were you a big fan of tarpon fishing? Tarpon.
No, I know a lot of the wrestlers were. In fact, Cowboy Luttrell, the promoter there in Tampa. Oh, he was a big-time fisherman. You can, you know, you go into the old newspaper archives for Tampa, Florida, the Tampa Tribune, and it seemed like every week they were publishing a story about Well, back then they didn't have the news they do today, so they were looking for things to print, you know. So they'd have articles in there every week about Cowboy Lutcher, noted pro wrestler promoter, went fishing today and caught two tarpon and, you know, whatever. I don't understand fishing, but they had things in the newspaper all the time. But I never was a fisherman. I'm one. I like to do things and see myself accomplishing something. And I hated sitting in. I went a few times. Friend and I, we'd get a boat and we'd go out. But most of the time we went, we'd sit there with our bait in the water and just, it would just sit there, you know, and we'd spend 3-4 hours and not even have any nibbles. And that to me, I just felt like such a waste of time. And I know I probably wasn't doing it right, you know, I wasn't doing what I should have been, you know, so I just never got into it.
Oh, okay. Right. Now, you said you did travel in your sophomore year in high school to that music camp. Did you yourself play an instrument?
Yes. That was my – I was heavily involved in the band in our high school, Southeast High School in Bradenton. I played the trumpet, and I played in the band, the orchestra, the stage band. I also got involved playing with the Florida West Coast Youth Symphony. It was in Sarasota, Florida, which is just below Tampa. So we'd go there every Saturday morning and practice or have our rehearsals, and then they'd have the big youth symphony concert. You know, 2-3 times a year we'd have a concert. And then when I came up to Trevecca Nazarene College, that actually was my major in college was music education. My goal was to be a band director, and I played trumpet. That was my performance, and trumpet was my minor. And so that's really what brought me up here to Nashville and, you know, really absolutely changed my life, because I never would have gotten the opportunity to do what I did in the wrestling business if I had stayed in Florida. Coming up here, they didn't – in Florida they had a guy that took care of the program, the arena programs, the pictures and all that kind of stuff that actually worked in the office. So I probably would have never gotten an opportunity what I, you know, was able to do here. But when I got here, they were looking for somebody to do that kind of thing. They had a guy named Mike Shields who did all the video work for Nick. He'd sit at ringside with a, 16 millimeter movie camera, I guess it was. And he'd shoot the matches, but he didn't have time to do all the other stuff, like shoot a lot of still photos. And I ended up creating the arena programs here in Nashville and selling those at the arena. So I guess the easiest way to put it is I was in the right place at the right time. And I'm just glad it worked out that way, because if I hadn't moved up here and gotten involved and through Nick Gulas, I would have never been doing any of what I'm doing now. And I'm just loving what I'm doing now.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that you found a profession where you enjoy your work. That's very important.
Yeah, it's funny you say profession, because really, I actually worked for UPS for 37 years. That was my full-time job. Pro wrestling, the magazines, the newsletters, that became, you know, big, almost like a magazine. All that was just a hobby. You know, I hardly never made any money off those. You know, it was just something I did and I enjoyed doing. The books are pretty much the same. I mean, I make some money off of it, but it's not worth the time I put into it. I mean, you know, it's just, there's just not that many wrestling fans who really enjoy reading about the old time pro wrestlers. Cause you got to face it, the old time fans who used to love pro wrestling in the 50s and the 60s, like I did, they're going dying off as quickly as the old time wrestlers are. So, you know, so it's just not that, it's not a lucrative thing. It's just something I love doing. And I'm retired now from UPS. After the 37 years, I was able to leave. And, now I spend my time during the day working on my books and, working on biographies with different guys and just living a dream.
Now, you didn't put down the trumpet for good, did you? I mean, do you still practice like an hour or two a day?
when I got out, I didn't become a band director. I ended up getting a part-time job at the time because I met my who would become my wife, and we ended up getting married. And she had another 2 years of school when we got married. So instead of trying to find a job as a teacher, you know, teaching band, teaching music in a high school, I just decided to work for UPS part-time because it paid real well. For a part-time work. I thought I'll just teach at UPS and I'll continue working for Nick Goulas doing the programs. And I had a whole table full of souvenirs and all kinds of things at the matches. And I decided to just do that until she got out of school. When she got out of school, we'd decide where we wanted to go live and I'd get a job teaching. So what happened was I was involved in pro wrestling and UPS. Well, I ended up getting on full time at UPS, and it was a no-brainer. I mean, UPS, it was a good company. They paid well, and I thought, you know, I talked it over with my wife, and it'd be crazy for me to – I mean, I liked music, but I wasn't crazy about teaching, and I wasn't crazy about marching band. I just never had a passion for it. So I decided to stay with UPS, and that's what I did, and that's why I didn't, you know, go on to become a teacher. I played trumpet for a little while after graduating college. I'd play in, you know, at church and things like that, but that was it. And it got to where I wasn't playing, you know, a few times a year. And, you know, if you don't practice, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. So I just sort of put it aside. And eventually one day I picked it up. I don't think I'd played at one point for like 5 years. And I picked up my trumpet. I thought, well, I'll just rip off a few scales and a few things and just to see how, you know, because for old time's sake, and I couldn't even get a note out. And that discouraged me so much that I said, that's it. I'm just not even worried about it. And so I ended up selling my trumpet I sold my trumpet maybe, I'd say about 20, 25 years ago and haven't touched it since.
Oh my, wow. I was going to ask, like, when you were in high school, were you considered somewhat of a rebel? And did you put anarchist messages on your trumpet to attract the women in high school, the girls?
I don't think so. No, definitely not. Nope.
Oh, all right. Oh, okay. Well, Scott, Sign Guy mentioned earlier that you worked for Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Were you ever ranked number 500 by them?
No, I wasn't a wrestler. They just ranked the wrestlers, and I really didn't work for Pro Wrestling Illustrated or Inside Wrestling. Actually, was the magazine. I just simply wrote articles for them. It wasn't anything I got paid for. I did it simply because I wanted the legends to be remembered. I wanted to do something in that national magazine, so people, when they pick it up and they read about Hulk Hogan and Lex Luger and Ric Flair, I wanted, so when they're turning the pages reading about all those guys, they come across this page about some guy who hadn't been in the wrestling ring in 15, 20, 30 years. I wanted people to remember those guys because those are the guys that actually paved the way for the guys that are wrestling today. If it hadn't been for them, you know, all the guys that came after them, you know, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, Steve Austin, none of them, you know, would be doing what they were, you know, what they were doing, what made them so famous, which is pro wrestling. So that was my whole idea for doing those articles. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't a paying gig, just something I chose to do because I wanted to help keep those guys, you know, memories alive.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, about that time that you moved up to Nashville, the territories were still hanging on, especially out here in Portland, with a promoter named Don Owens. And there was a tag team that used to wrestle for Don Owens called the Kangaroos that were comprised of Sir Charles and Lord Jonathan Boyd. Are you familiar with this tag team, and did you ever come across them, the Kangaroos?
Oh, absolutely. I never met Jonathan Boyd, but I did know. I knew Norman Frederick Charles III. Actually, he called me, I guess about a month ago. He called me. I hadn't heard from him in a couple of years, and I had stayed in touch with Norman for a long time. But yes, I know both of them real well. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, now.
And by the way, when you mentioned Portland, and you mentioned Don Owen, the promoter. It's Owen. There's no S on the end of it. It's Don Owen singular. There's no S.
Oh, okay.
So people make the same mistake with the promoter in San Francisco, you know, back then. It was a guy named Roy Shire. Everybody calls him Roy Shires, but it's not Roy Shires. It's Roy Shires, you know, just with no S on the end. And it's the same with Don Owen, but that's a mistake everybody makes.
Oh, okay. All right. Duly noted. All right. Well, in your interview with Killer Carl Cox, he mentioned some of the promoters that he liked and some of the promoters that he didn't like. Do you think Killer Carl Cox would have got along with Don Owen?
Carl would have gotten along with anybody, you know, provided they treated him well and paid him, you know, what he expected. And chances are, if they didn't pay him what he expected, he would have gotten along with the promoter anyway, but he wouldn't have stayed. He would have gone on somewhere else because he was so good. He could, you know, he could pretty much write his ticket anywhere he wanted to go. You know, there was a lot of promoters that would have, you know, loved to had Carl Cox in there, you know, wrestle for them. So, oh yeah, Carl didn't have any problem with promoters. It just some he didn't like because they, you know, didn't come through with what they said they would pay, or you know, he just didn't. And it may even have been a thing where they didn't see this eye to eye with the way he wanted to present himself or the way he things he wanted to do, you know, as far as wrestling goes. So those are the only ones he'd have a problem with. Carl, he made a lot of money for promoters. He was a big draw, drew a lot of fans to the ring. So yeah, he'd have gotten along with Don just fine.
Good. Okay. Well, most people did because Don Owen did treat his wrestlers well, and he was rumored to be very fair with everyone's pay and never stopped anyone.
Right. I agree with that. I heard nothing but good things about Don until I began writing my books and my magazine, and all of a sudden I started running across guys who did have a problem with Don Owen, who didn't think he was doing what they should, you know. But that's the way it is with every promoter. You hear you hear a lot less about Don Owen being a bad guy because most of the guys do have good things to say about him. Same with Sam Muchnick. You hear very few people say anything bad about Sam Muchnick. Of course, Carl Cox was one of the ones that did say something bad about Sam Muchnick. He didn't like the way whatever it was, you know, that he didn't like that Sam did. And Sam was known as one of the best payoff promoters in the world. You know, he had one town, St. Louis. That's all he ran, and the guys just loved going to work for him. But again, no matter who you talk to about a particular promoter, eventually you're going to run across people who didn't like that promoter for whatever reason.
Wow, okay, all right, okay. Well, Scott, you mentioned you interviewed a wrestler named Carl von Stroheim. Didn't he do some wrestling out in Portland, Oregon in the early 70s under the name Carl von Steiger?
No, those are two different people. There's a tag team called Kurt and Carl von Steiger. Right off the top of my head, I can't tell you where they were from, but I know Carl ended up moving to Hawaii later on. In fact, I know he did because Rocky Johnson was just recently telling me that he had been to Hawaii several years ago and Carl was still there. But no, that was a different tag team. The one that I had the interview with in my book was Carl von Stroheim. He wrestled with another guy named it was a German named Willy Rutkowski as Kurt and Carl von Stroheim, and I'm trying to remember if Carl wrestled as one of the Von Brauners for a short time. But anyway, they're two separate teams. They're two totally different teams. And to make matters even more confusing, there was two different teams that called themselves Von Brauner, Kurt and Carl von Brauner. Actually, there was another one on a small independent, too, so there was actually three teams of Von Brauner. So it gets so confusing. But the Kurt and Carl von Steiger, if you see a picture of them, you'll see there is a totally – they have a totally different look than the Von Brauners or the Von Stroheims.
Oh, okay. Well, I remember that Kurt and Carl used to come to the ring with their black boots with a red iron cross on them.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That was their deal. You know, that's how they got their heat. You know, they pretend acted like they were Nazis, you know, and one difference, and I really never thought of this. One difference between the von Brauners and the von Stroheims and the von Steigers was I don't remember the von Steigers ever having a manager. The von Brauners and the von Stroheims, they always had a manager. The von Brauners, it was almost always Saul Weingroff, gentleman Saul Weingroff. Saul was, oh, what a wonderful person he was. But as a wrestling fan, you would absolutely hate him because he was, I always say, he was a weasel face. You know, he looked like a weasel. but I say that with all the love I have for him because I love Saul, but he had the part down. I mean, people hated him because of the way, you know, the way he looked and the way he talked and the way he came across on camera. But the Von Steigers, I suppose they were really good talkers. The wrestlers that had managers, for the most part, and this isn't always, but for the most part, had a manager because they didn't feel comfortable on the mic, you know, when it came time to doing interviews, promos. So they had a manager that would do their talking for them. So that would sort – I haven't seen the Von Steigers more than just a handful of times, and that's when they were right here in Tennessee. So I would venture to say that they probably were pretty good talkers on the mic without a manager.
Oh, yeah. Yes, they were. Yeah. Okay. Well, now, did you ever have a chance to interview Roddy Piper?
No, Roddy was after my time. Not after my time, but he didn't get started till it was probably late, shortly before I got out of the wrestling business. So, and I never have even met Roddy. So, no, I never had talked with him.
Well, that would have been great if Roddy had heard your reputation as a trumpet player and he would have given you bagpipe lessons. That would have been
Irish. We could have had a duet.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, Scott, when you got through with Ole Anderson and other wrestlers asked you to write their books, did you start to feel like the great Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson at that point?
Like the what? Repeat that.
Did you start to feel like the great Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson?
Oh, no. I never took myself seriously. I just do what I love doing. And I just have a passion for recording this history. I guess the best way to put it is when one of these guys passes away, if they haven't told their story to somebody like me and we haven't gotten their story down from them, then when they die, all the memories, all the stories they have about the pro wrestling business are gone forever. Because the pro wrestling business was so different from any other business, any other sport. Other sports, they kept records. I mean, you know, they'd have Sporting Digest or Sports Illustrated, and they have all these records and statistics and stories, even, you know, stories about things that happen, you know, like pro baseball players, you know, might write a book and they'd have stories about their time in baseball, things that happen on the road, you know, on the way to different ball games, after ball games, in the locker rooms. Well, pro wrestling never had that because it was a secret society. Nobody was allowed in the pro wrestling business. Nobody was allowed to know anything. And the promoters never wrote anything down because they didn't want the public to know any of this stuff. It was what we call kayfabe or secret. The only people privy to that kind of information were people who were actually in the pro wrestling business. So my goal is to talk to as many of these guys as I can and get as much of this history preserved before they're gone. Because as I said, once they're gone, then all that history is gone as well.
Yes, I agree with that. And, you know, Scott, I'm in possession right now of a book called The King of New Orleans, How the Junkyard Dog Became Professional Wrestling's First Black Superstar. And the author is named Greg Klein. Are you familiar with Greg Klein's work, and did you have an opportunity to meet him?
No, I've never, I mean, I hate to say it, but I've never met, never even heard of the guy. I mean, I'm sure the book's good, and I guess it is. I don't know, but yeah, I'm sure he has something to tell. I just don't know who he is. I sure don't.
Oh, okay. All right.
I see it here now. I just looking here on Amazon. I do see it listed here, but no, I sure don't know. I hope I don't know Greg, because I feel bad. But most of the people I have written books that I've been in touch with, I would remember. So I just don't know anything about him or the book itself. So
now, when the picture you're looking at, does it have the picture of the junkyard dog on the front?
Yeah, with a crown on top of the king.
Yes. Now, yes, boy, I sure wouldn't want to run across him in a dark alley if he was looking like that.
Yeah, he was a big guy. He wrestled for us here long before he became the Junkyard Dog. He came in here around 70, I'd want to say 78, maybe 79, and he was still wrestling under his real name, Sylvester Ritter, at the time. But he was a nice guy. You know, I had no problems with, you know, he's big, and, you know, it doesn't look any different really than some of these big football players. You know, he's just a big, tough guy, you know. But he was nice as could be. I never, you know, never had a problem with him. He's always very friendly.
Now, speaking of all the wrestlers that you have interviewed, did you ever feel obligated, or did the wrestlers feel obligated themselves to give you a knife-edge chop? Did that ever happen?
To get what? Give me what?
Give you a knife-edge chop. Did they feel obligated to give you?
No, I can't say they did.
Oh, okay.
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, in your interview with Killer Carl Cox, he mentioned Sputnik Monroe throwing up on his dashboard. What was up with that?
Oh, those guys, they do anything. A lot of people, you know, they wonder why they did the crazy things they did. Sputnik was just, you know, he was a drinker. He drank a lot, and I'm sure that's what happened. You know, he just got sick. And I mean, I used to hear stories about Sputnik. He'd get a ride from somebody, and he'd be in the back seat, you know, where there'd be three or four wrestlers, and next thing they hear this noise, they look back, and he's peeing in his beer can, and he'd sit it down on the floor, and they'd say they'd get to where they're going. They'd get home the next morning, and here's the can had fallen over, and there's urine all over the floorboard of the car. And some of the guys just had no class, you know, and things like that. But they, you know, they were always involved with pulling ribs on each other and doing crazy. They do crazy things. I mean, they get drunk and things like that, but they do crazy ribs on each other, pulled practical jokes, just as a way to entertain themselves. They'd get in the car at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and they drive, you know, until 6. They drive 200-300 miles, and a lot of times back then they didn't have the interstate, so it would take, you know, 3-4 hours just to go 150 miles, and they would look for anything they could do to pass the time, because it was so boring on the road that they did things just to have fun. And they did some pretty outlandish stuff, which a lot of those stories come out in my books. You know, they tell about this, some of the things they did, crazy things, stuff that today, granted, you could never do. You'd be arrested for a lot of stuff they used to do.
Oh yeah. Like mooning other cars.
Oh, that was mild. I mean, Don Fargo, he and Jackie Fargo, Jackie had a convertible, and they were huge, big names here in Tennessee for a long time in the late 50s, early 60s. First thing they do before they leave for a match is they take all their clothes off, and they go to the matches in this convertible naked. If Don was with 3 or 4 other guys in a different car, he'd say, just keep the car steady. He'd take his clothes off, and he'd climb out the window and up on the roof and stand on the roof doing muscle poses naked. I mean, stuff they did, it was the craziest stuff. And, yes, they'd have been arrested so quickly today if they got caught doing anything. But back then, they were celebrities. Things weren't as politically correct as they are today. And those guys got away with just an unbelievable amount of stuff that you never could get away with today.
Wow. All right. Well, Scott, it was very nice talking with you. And if you decide, if you come across your old trumpet, I might make a bid for it.
I'll do that. If I find out who has it, I'll tell them. And because it's probably worth something because it belonged to me, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I've enjoyed it, and I appreciate your program. I appreciate the fact that you're where the organizations today, like the WWE, they've sort of forgotten the old-timers. And I appreciate it, you know, people like you with podcasts who are willing to talk with people who remember the old days so that we can help keep these old guys alive in the minds of the today's fans, or maybe even educate some of the current-day fans about pro wrestling as it was in the past.
Well, the pleasure was all here on this side of the table. And at this time, I'm going to turn it back over to Stein Guy.
Thank you. Good talk to you.
Thank you, QT. Well, Scott, we have a few minutes left in the program, and I want to give that time to you. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners, plug and promote anything you got, social medias, website, merchandise, anything at all, floor is all yours.
Well, thank you. Yeah, anybody who would like to learn more about any of my books, DVDs, or anything, any of the material I've got, they can go to, it's real easy, just go to Crowbar Press, Crowbar, like the crowbar you use in your car, crowbarpress.com, and everything is featured there, and I have a lot of stuff on there, like excerpts from the books you can read, great stories from the books you can read. I guess the main thing I would say is I hope everybody who enjoys pro wrestling today would take some time to look into the past and just to see what pro wrestling was all about in the old days, because it was a totally different thing from what it is today. And there's a lot of great stories and great history in the past. So that's my main thrust, is to get people more interested in the older times and to read up and learn more about it.
Well, it has been our absolute pleasure having you here. And I always enjoy your books. I've read several of them. Look forward to getting some more of them and enjoying even more of your work. And I want to thank you for all you do, keeping the history of professional wrestling alive.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's people like you who keep me motivated.
Well, fans, if you have not picked up any of the books that Scott Till has done, head over to crowbarpress.com, pick yourself up a few. They're all great quality, so make sure you do that. Definitely check out some of the interviews and so forth that he's put out there. You'll learn a lot about the wrestling industry, I guarantee you that. We will be back with you Sunday afternoon. We have Thomas Swanson, the promoter out of Cascade Championship Wrestling. Should be an interesting show on Sunday, so make sure you get out there, support your local wrestling, and tune back in with us on Sunday.
Given everything. walking in